Hey, everyone. If you're hearing me instead of Earl Strickland or Tyler Steyer in the introduction, you know that there's probably an announcement coming. This is going to be no different. So back on January 13th for the episode for the podcast, I had kind of asked for help from the listeners to really implement, I guess what I'll call phase one of the podcast's direction in the near future. And that was basically to, I want to get away from sponsors. I want to get away from sponsors to the podcast for a lot of the reasons that I have in the 13th. So if you haven't heard that, head over to January 13th and listen to the introduction for that podcast. But so what I said in that introduction for that episode was I was really hoping to, I guess, expand out the podcast as much as I possibly can over the next few months. I'm in kind of a weird spot in my life where I'm in school and I'm going to be finishing up very soon. And I have a lot of different directions that I could go, both in life and with this podcast in general. So I'm kind of going all in on trying to build something close to sustainable so that if and when I'm able to get out of school and have the opportunity to work a normal 9-to-5 job, like normal America, I'm trying to set myself up to possibly not have to do that, or at least not have to do that in the traditional sense. And I want to not have to do that more or less because I want this to be what I do going forward. I would love to be able to help the game grow in the ways that I see possible by what I've built thus far, both by myself and with the help of the co-hosts and the fans themselves. Because when I put this kind of challenge out to the listeners is, far as, you know, sharing to your friends, getting it out on your Facebook page or on AZ Billiards or anything like that, the response was crazy. We've actually added about 75 to 175, somewhere in that range, new listeners in just the last 3 weeks. There's no way I could have done that. Well, I didn't do any of that. I mean, that was completely all the listeners helping out and supporting the cause of expanding the podcast and getting that out there. So I cannot thank everybody enough. And that is also why I wanted to kind of help give back and at least do something for the people who are doing the work, which is why we're doing the little competition for the Moscone Cup magazine and a couple of other smaller prizes. So I thank everybody so much for all that effort and ask that if you are willing to continue to keep it up so that we could try to get expanded as much as possible over the coming weeks and months. But with that is kind of phase one. And if there's one thing that I like to do, especially with this podcast, I like to be extremely transparent. There's a lot of sketchy promoters out there, or there at least has been in the past in the world of pool, and I'm trying not to be one of them. I am trying to be as transparent as I possibly can with the direction that I see the podcast going and my decisions and my reasonings for my decisions. So phase one of, I guess, this all in kind of balls to the wall expansion of the podcast was just that, trying to get as many people out there listening to the podcast or the content on the Facebook page as possible. Phase two is now going to be an actual expansion of the content of this podcast. And this is going to be very unique in a sense that when I started this podcast, I had no idea what I was doing. I didn't know how to edit audio. I didn't know how to produce shows. I didn't even know how to like promote or interview or anything like that. All of that I kind of taught myself along the way. I've had some growing pains. Anybody who's been around since the beginning knows that it hasn't always been a smooth ride, but I think that I'm to the point now where I'm able to do this well enough that it's not terrible. So if you disagree, please reach out, let me know. But what I want to do next is I want to expand the actual content for which the podcast puts out. And I want to do that basically using videos and live streams. So I've tossed around the idea of actually doing some live podcasts. I've tossed around the idea of doing many different things as far as at tournaments themselves, actually going there and doing live interviews with players or with the promoters, stuff like that. But to be able to do all of these things, there is going to be a lot more equipment that I'm going to need to purchase. There's a lot more travel expenses. There's a lot more funding that I'm going to need to have to be able to do some of these things. So I guess that kind of brings me to where I am right now, which is I have set up a YouTube channel. And with that YouTube channel, I plan on doing things in the future with not only some of this video content, but hopefully different advertising sponsorship possibilities that are going to be completely independent from the podcast. The podcast is going to be separate from that. But I hope that that will bring in some revenue as far as actually having people advertising on the YouTube page. Whether it will or whether it won't, I don't know. So actually, if there's anybody out there, the listeners that have any experience in this and could reach out to me and help guide me with some of this stuff, or just give me a couple like, you know, loose advice or stuff, anything like that, that would be super appreciated. But the second way I'm hoping to create some sort of funding for the podcast is through the Patreon system. And for anybody who doesn't know what the Patreon system is, it is essentially basically somebody who supports content. The way that it's used now in, I guess, the podcasting and the video vlogging and lots of other different, more X-rated ways of content these days is it's for people who want to basically support the things that they ingest. So the podcasting is always going to be free. I'm not changing that. I mean, I'm not even remotely interested in that, but it allows if you so choose, this is not going to be required, and I'll talk more about that later, but it is not going to be required to partake in this. Basically, all it is it's a system that if you wanted to help support the content that I will be putting out, not only now and in the past, but also in the future, it's a way that you can set up a type of recurring donation, I guess, to the podcast monthly that allows you to, I guess, really help support and create the content that we're going to have going forward. So, and if you're already an expert in Patreon and you know what it is, the Patreon that's set up for the podcast is going to be patreon.com/queueitup. So Patreon is patreon.com/CUEITUP. So if you are already an expert in Patreon and you know kind of how it works and you're interested or willing to help out the podcast going forward, you can head over there without a link, which is exciting. If you're not, I will put a link out on the Facebook page itself. And if you so choose, you can head over there and you could set up a Patreon donation to the podcast. It will hopefully be in the future. I'm going to have tiers in the very, very near future. I need to think about how this is going to work out more in-depthly, but I am going to have probably a three-tiered system where the base tier is going to be basically like you just want to support the podcast in a small way. Maybe it's a couple bucks a month. Maybe it's a dollar. Maybe it's a quarter a month. Who knows? It's kind of whatever you so choose if you want to. The second tier will probably actually have a little bit of incentives for it. This might be anywhere from $5 to $10 a month or whatever I decide to choose. I need to talk to a few more people on this. But and this will actually have small perks that maybe you'll get a patch sent or a sticker or maybe a t-shirt after a couple months. You'll get a free t-shirt, something like that. That is basically a thank you for your willingness to support the podcast. And then I'm going to have a top tier. And this top tier is going to be a little bit more expensive. It's going to be basically people who are willing to, you know, really give and help support the podcast. And I think what I'm going to do for that is I'm actually going to, at a certain funding level, you will actually get to join the podcast and actually be a part of the podcast. Not only for individual episodes, but in some of the future planning, because if you're willing to really support the podcast at that level, I think your opinion for the podcast should truly matter. I mean, you truly have the podcast, and I guess the Cue It Up brand is as a whole, really, you really have the best interest of us in mind. So I think it'd be a good idea to bring you on, help make decisions towards the future, as well as actually joining some of the podcasts to basically give your opinions on stuff. So that's kind of it. The Patreon system, if you need a little bit more information on it, please do not hesitate to reach out. It's basically just a system that allows you to help to donate to some of the future content that the podcast will have. And hopefully I will be able to get out some really, really good stuff. And you'll feel like if you're willing to donate and invest in the future of the podcast, that you will be happy with it. And So if you don't want to, you absolutely do not have to. The podcast is still going to be free. Some people listen just because they like the information. They, you know, it's just kind of whatever to them. They're not super passionate about it. They just enjoy listening to it from time to time. That's totally fine. The podcast will still be free. You do not have to financially support it in any way. This is just for the people who want to help invest in the future of the podcast, to get out new content. Exciting new content, exciting new ventures that we can take on in the future, and all of that good stuff. So with that, we can actually get into the podcast. I won't take up any more time. But if you need any more information on anything, or just want to chat out some future strategies that you think the podcast should do to help make it more successful in the future, please do not hesitate to reach out to myself or the podcast or anybody on the podcast. So with that, here's the show.
I'm a real deal. I'll shoot your liver out and hand it to you.
So, part two of the podcast, we will actually go into the normal, your quote-unquote normal weekly episode. And again, I'm still joined with Rob Hovek. Rob, what's up?
Nate, this is part two.
This is part two.
So let's get into it.
Hi, Demetrius.
Hello, everyone in podcast world.
And your last name is pronounced Gelatus? Gelatus? Gelatus?
It's just one time, but Gelatus. Yep.
Gelatus. Okay, so we got that right.
It's good. Not Gelatus cubed.
No.
So we'll jump right in. We'll get started with all of the stuff that we have to do in the beginning of the podcast. And it'll start with, I have a big shout out and thank you to Kyle Nolan, who is with Q-Tech. And they have sent the podcast to try out for review the Q-Tech Breach, which is their break queue. They have sent me a Shane Van Boning Gen 1 and a Synergy shooting queue. And then they have also sent me the Propel. I've got to hit a little bit with all three of them last night, not too much. So I don't want to go super in depth as far as any reviews or anything, but I did actually hit quite a bit with the Propel, and wow. I mean, it is stupid easy to jump with. I'm not good at jumping short distances, but I mean, I was even getting up balls less than 3 inches away with accuracy and consistency. So, I mean, there's going to be a lot more coming from the Propel soon, but... Actually, Demetrius, have you ever had an opportunity to hit with any of those products from Q-Tech?
No, you've got me interested. I might be in the market for a jump queue, so I'd love to. Next time we get together, I'll try it out.
I think that's a good idea. At some point in time, maybe in the next couple weeks, maybe we'll have to get together and meet officially for the first time.
But, well, I want to be there because. When he sees you jump, he's just not going to believe it. I'm serious, Demi. You're not going to believe it. He's the best I've ever seen.
Wow.
I jumped the balls all right. I jumped the balls okay.
Listen to this. All right. Yeah. All right. He can jump a ball 4 feet anywhere on the table and hit the backside of the ball. Land on the backside of the ball so it goes the other way.
That is not true.
It is true. I've seen it. So,
Rob, you make me.
You know
like
what
blushing.
That means.
I'm like
if
blushing.
If you've got a ball that's past the side pocket, and you can't cut it, you just jump it.
Yeah,
even if there's no balls in the way.
That'd be a great shot for one pocket. Right, your opponent lays down a good break. You just jump on the far side of the ball hook, and you just back cut it in your pocket. maybe Tony Johan. I don't know.
Yeah, wouldn't that be a shot?
I feel like
just take out your jump cue.
I feel like if you get a player like Evan Lundy, when like you get him frustrated enough, and he's got so much talent in the game of one pocket, you get him frustrated enough, and he probably might even try a shot like that, and he'll probably hit it pretty good.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
So where are we going now?
Yeah, we're going to move on from that. We'll have to keep in touch, Demetrius, as when we're going to meet up, because I think this Propel is it's worth trying for sure. So we will move on from that to the podcast has an official YouTube account now. And the YouTube account is going to be, you can go to YouTube and you should be able to just search Cue It Up podcast. and we should come up. And if you would, please go over there and subscribe. Even if you have no intentions on ever watching any of the content that we eventually put up, which I'm actually planning on adding some more stuff. I actually might even put all of these podcasts there just in audio form. But even if you don't ever plan on checking out any of that content, there's a lot of things that YouTube requires you to have a certain amount of subscribers for until you can actually even get access to some of their features. So I know the first milestone before we can actually get anything is 100 subscribers. So I posted it to the Facebook page, and we've actually had about 20 people in the first hour and a half go over and subscribe. So it's been a great turnout to begin with. But hopefully the podcast will help get a few more people over there so we can, you know, get up to that 100 threshold. And the next one after that is 250, and that'll open up a few more features. But we'll take baby steps. Head over there, please, 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 and subscribe so that we can really start doing some stuff with it. That doesn't really need too much more expansion. So we will move on to last week. We had a bit of a, I don't even know what you want to call it, a competition, sweepstakes, I don't know. There's a little competition, I guess, we're having for the Moscone Cup magazine signed by the U.S. players. And basically, I challenged any of the listeners who are out there who wanted to help out and want to be rewarded for it. Anytime you share anything that has to do with the podcast, you are entered in exactly one time. So if you went and shared everything that we've ever done, every single one of those is an entry in. So at the end of the month, February, we will take a random drawing of all of the people that were in there. So head over there and share some stuff. But I did want to give a update for all of the people who have done it since, I guess, the last podcast. And according to my records, so if these are not correct, make sure that you reach out to the podcast or me personally and tell me that you did do this. And I guess show me the where you did it. But by my unofficial account, the best I can do, I have Alan Davis getting 4 entries as the most, Sean Hanna getting 3, David James getting 2, the Sneaky Pete Mafia page getting 1 entry, Nikki Wera getting 2, Natasha Zazaba getting 1, Tim Clark getting 1, Sarah Schmidt getting 1, Tracy Featherly getting 1, and Gary Browning getting 1 entry all. So I am paying attention to these. I am writing them down. I have a spreadsheet out there, so if you want to get entry to a free Moscone Cup pamphlet from the actual Moscone Cup signed by the U.S. players, or a t-shirt or a patch for the prizes, every time that you share anything that the queued up Facebook page puts out there, you're entered in once. And this is all, again, to try to get the podcast out there to as many people as possible over the next few months. So with that, we will move on to our shout outs. And Demetrius, so we give a shout out before the podcast starts to, you know, anybody that you want, basically. And it is just one person. It's basically just a way of, you know, getting out some people that I guess we want to give highlights to. So I will start it out, and I will actually give my shout out to Kyle Nolan for sending me all the Q-Tech stuff. And he's been super easy to work with. He's a super nice guy, and we've been chatting on the phone a little bit here and there. And so I will give my shout out to him for sending me all the Q-Tech stuff to be able to try out. Rob, why don't you go next?
I'm going to shout out to, you mentioned his name already, Sean Hanna, Wisconsin pool player. Holds a distinction, Sean does, in his life, beating the famous Larry Neville in a race to 7 in a bar tournament in the southern part of the state around 1998, I want to say, something like that. But Sean posts our podcast stuff. I see it on Facebook a lot. And he was a very good pool player not too many years ago, and enthusiastic, a pool enthusiast. And if you ever want to know anything about gambling of any type, casino-type gambling especially, get a hold of Sean. He'll tell you all about it, tell you the ins and outs, the do's and don'ts.
All right.
So there's my shout-out to Sean.
So why don't you go – so Dimitri?
I've just got one person that jumps to mind, and that's our man Aaron Taylor. He's the man that introduced us, and also a religious queued up supporter. And of course, he was one of the first people to come out and go through the pool boot camp experience I offer. And that was it was just a very rewarding time. And so as a friend, as a listener, and as a pool player, thank you, Aaron.
Yeah, if there's like a list of like the most passionate fans of the podcast, or like the fan who has helped the most, Aaron Taylor's like first, second, third, fourth, and fifth. He's done so much with like buying gear or like hanging the queued up podcast in Hard Times Billiards. I mean, he has done so much to help the podcast grow. So Aaron Taylor's been my shout out in the past, and I completely echo everything you said. He's been great for the podcast. And with that, we can jump into the rest of the podcast. So obviously, it's great to have Demetrius on this week, because not only was he at Derby City Classic, he participated in it. And that is going to be the bulk of what we're talking about this week. And this is where I can insert my foot in my mouth and say that I was wrong. I had Billy Thorpe winning the all-around, and it was looking really, really good after about day five of the Derby City Classic. But Dennis Arroyo comes back and ends up winning. Or I guess doing enough in the nine ball to take that away from Billy. But I guess we'll start it out with Demetrius. And what was the atmosphere like there? And what was it like competing there?
Well, Derby's a ton of fun. I mean, it's just an extravaganza. You know, you've got hundreds and hundreds of people moving around. And it gets, you know, I don't know. It's just everybody's there in terms of all the top players. Although, of course, this year there was a couple people that couldn't attend because of the 21 and under rule. And a couple of the Taiwanese and Chinese contingency weren't there. But you know, there's such a strong international representation that it seems like all the top players are there. And then just everybody there loves pool. So as far as like that race and the points race, yeah, I unfortunately, you know, because I'm playing, there's a lot of it I didn't really get to sweat. You know, so you guys in some ways might have been more better in tune with I know what happened is, yeah, I mean, Billy Thorpe, I mean, I watched him play Justin Hall in the finals of the one pocket, and I watched him win that. And so I knew he was leading because I knew he finished deep in the banks as well. And I think if I remember right, and then Dennis just didn't Dennis win the banks? And then he
played, you know what? I watched the whole thing, the finals.
Yeah.
And I swear, well, he won 3-0 or 3-1. No, 3-0, but one game was 5-1.
Gotcha.
I believe. And Lunda only had four turns. He only took four shots in three games. Dennis only, I think he only missed four times.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the guy, I mean, I remember the first time when Dennis Arcullo played Scott Frost, and they played like a race to 41 pocket. And I remember there was two things I remember from that set. So anybody that watched that, I think that was about 3 or 4 years ago. One thing was that Scott would have Dennis down 7-0, 7-1, 7-2 on ball count. And Dennis won the majority of those games. Like he just wiggled his way back and came back. It was pretty shocking. And I'm like, man, it's pretty tough when you're playing and you're up 7-1 of a guy and you can't win a game. It's pretty discouraging, right? But then the other thing I remember about that set was that every time he had a cross bank where you had to cut a ball across corner, you know, balls on the first or second diamond by Scott's side rail. Anytime he had a cross bank, I mean, it was, you know, some players are the underdog to make them. Some players make them around 50-50. Great players make them a little bit better than half the time. I mean, I don't really have stats for this. So somebody that's, you know, more of a pen, you know, somebody that's more of a pen and paper kind of guy might call me on this. It was almost 90% plus. I mean, he made almost every cross bank he shot at the whole night for multiple days. And so anyway, I never really got a chance to watch Dennis play too much banks. But just from that one display, I was like, man, the guy really knows his rails. That's for sure.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, and he was making those banks the longer kind of weird angle, short rail to short rail, all full length of the table banks. He was making those. They weren't hitting the rail coming into the pocket. They were dead center in the middle of the hole, every single one that whole last match. He never touched a rail going in.
Well, and I think a lot of people think of banks as kind of a gaffy game, like a carny game, where it's like, you know, and sure, you might have some players that can do well and win the banks potentially, even that aren't necessarily competitive. And in other games that involves, you know, more striking. But the fact is that Banks are extremely speed sensitive and aim sensitive and cue ball, you know, spin sensitive, which means that how you strike the balls and the consistency with which you deliver your cue in terms of speed, accuracy of hit and the strike on the cue ball, those little differences are so critical that you get a guy like Dennis. And really, I think it speaks to how well he cues the balls, because, you know, I normally don't think of Dennis as being a premier banker, but because he can deliver his cue with the strike he wants and the stroke he wants and the hit he wants, he hits his target so accurately. And Banks is a game that, you know, when you're shooting a shot in the hole, you know, you can get away with accidentally putting a little side spin on the cue ball or wobbling it in a little bit. Or if you have a decelerating, not very confident stroke, you can still kind of get away with it a lot of the time. But on Banks shots, Banks will expose any lack of confidence or accuracy. And I think that speaks to the fact that Dennis, I think, has just a high level of confidence and a high level of accuracy when it comes to stroking and striking the cue ball.
Yeah, I noticed. I never saw a lot of side spin on the object balls going in. They were always spinning end over end, rolling natural end over end. There was never an exaggerated amount of jump off the rails. So the speed he was... The speed, the sensitivity he was stroking that with or cueing that shot with was really fine tuned. I noticed that right away. He's not, you know, a lot of guys that I saw in the Banks, they hit them a little harder. They're just, you know, I see these great bank players, they're just popping balls in all over the place. But not Dennis. Dennis cued them in. And I was in awe watching that last match.
Well, I'll tell you, too, you know, just as far as practical value to the listeners, I mean, I will admit that, you know, I spent a lot of my life avoiding bank shots. You know, when I grew up, I would play safety instead of betting the game on difficult banks. But the problem with that is you get higher and higher levels. You know, when I was a kid, I could play safe on a guy. He'd kick and miss. I'd get ball in hand. I run out. In my mind, I played perfect. But then you go and do the same thing against a high-level player. They kick, hit the ball, leave you awkward. You play a save, they make a hero shot, run three racks on you. All of a sudden you realize, well, maybe I got to start banking these balls.
Yeah.
So there's a totally different way it plays out. And you might not even think you made a mistake, because in your mind, hey, I played safe, I got ball in hand, I ran out, I played perfect, but yeah, not good enough. So, but what I would say is, anybody that's listening, I avoided banks, but now having seen this, I've added banks to my regimen of practice. You know, I've really, my regimen, I've been really, since I've come home, I'm like, I've been practicing a lot of long rail banks, both with firm speed and pocket speed. It's just, it really is a super strong feedback on how you're striking the balls.
Yeah, immediate too. I mean, it's immediate feedback. It's like missing a shot or not. I mean, it's just like, you know, right, the ball hits the rail and it tells you immediately what you just did to the cue ball. Right or wrong.
Yes. And so that was Dennis. And then meanwhile, Billy Thorpe, so I got a chance to see that one. So Billy Thorpe won the one pocket. He played Justin Hall. I saw that match, and I'll tell you, it was funny, man, because Justin really looked, you know, he got it to 2-2 and erased it.
Yeah.
Race to three, he made it two.
Breaks the balls and doesn't touch the table again. How often does that happen?
But before we get to that, I'll tell you, Justin looked a little, you know, a little off. I mean, he was making some erratic shot selections. Like everyone that knows the shot, he played like he was straight in a ball on his end rail. The ball, the cue ball, and the object ball were both maybe, I don't know, 4 inches off the end rail, and he played an extreme rail first shot with speed that was kind of questionable, and it rattled back and went over to his, you know, Billy's hole and sold out.
Right.
And he made a number of decisions that were, I mean,
he miscued one time too. That was kind of nasty.
He did what now?
Had a miscue on a pretty easy shot.
Yeah. He got control. He had a chance.
That was a game shot.
Yeah. And so now don't get me wrong. He made a lot of good decisions, and he also made some great shots, and he got it to 2-2. But the funny part is that watching him play, it looked like he was fighting himself and kind of struggling to settle in and kind of, it wasn't the smoothest I've seen him look. Meanwhile, Billy looked so confident and so, you know, aggressive and authoritative. It just, even when it went 2-2, You know, I mean, you can sit there and say, well, it's one game, anything can happen. But it really felt like it was going to be hard for Justin to win. And then when he broke the balls, I'll tell you, the one thing that I thought was funny is, for those that didn't see, Justin broke the balls, and Billy could see there was a ball near Justin's side rail that Billy couldn't see enough to bank it straight in his pocket, but he could see it enough to kind of back. He could see the bottom of the ball. He could cut it back into the side rail and bank it back towards the rack and have it carom off a cluster towards his pocket. And so he played this back cut bank carom, and it happened to go in, and then he ran eight and out. But the part about that is that the way he played it, I actually think that he got – I mean, so there was a little debate on AZ Billiards about whether or not he got lucky. And everyone's like, well, that's a common one-pocket shot. And I'm like, yeah, but the problem was he didn't get his cue ball up high enough. Had that ball not gone in, he would have left Justin. So Justin was straight on a couple of banks cross corner, where Justin would have been very – he would have had a free bank and a safe bank and a routine bank to where, you know, when he's playing that shot, he's playing to bounce the cue ball off the end rail and get it to slide up by the third diamond and get it high enough that the stack hooks him. But he didn't. He cut bait that ball into the stack, into that cluster, but the cue ball died out in space by like the first and a half diamond, where if that ball hadn't have gone in, he was in big trouble. And I actually think that, so I don't know, did he get lucky? Not, I don't know. It looked like he was there to win. It looked like he wanted to win, and it looked like he shot a winning shot and ran eight. So obviously he found a way to run out. But I do think that he was a little fortunate, because even as busted out as Justin was looking at that moment, if that ball didn't go in, Justin was straight on a cross corner. And I think that even if he wasn't feeling that great at that moment, give him a straight back bank for the win, and he might perk up a little bit. So anyway, the point is, it was really, really close, and it was a lot of drama. That's for sure.
Yeah, there was. That was a good match. I watched that finals, too.
So that was Justin and Billy, and shout out to both of them. I mean, great job getting to the finals. But what about the nine ball? So Filler looks like he's unbeatable. He's beaten everybody. He's beaten, you know, he's undefeated getting to the finals. And you know, here he has won everything in the last 2 years, it seems like. It seems almost impossible for anybody to beat the guy.
Especially in nine ball.
What's that?
Especially in nine ball, if I can cut in. I mean, 10 ball.
Oh, yeah.
10 ball, he looks a little bit human. I mean, he's beatable in 10 ball, but 9 ball, he looks freakishly good.
Yeah, and so when he gets to the finals, now I unfortunately didn't get to see the finals, so now I got to ask you guys. I've read a little bit about it, but what did Lee Van come with in the finals? How did he get that job done?
Oh, Lee Van came with everything. I mean, Lee Van, he played close to perfect. I mean, I think the AccuStats that I saw by the time the match was done is he was in like the mid 900s. And Joshua Filler, I mean, if I'm not mistaken, he didn't even get like a real opportunity at the table until he was down 5 or 6 to nothing. I mean, Levan had the match of his career from what I've seen thus far.
Yeah, what I was told was that Levan did not miss a ball that he intended to pocket, and that he might have had a dry break, or he might have had a, you know, something where, you know, he might have missed his tape or something and had to play safe. But I was told that he didn't miss a pocketable ball, and the write-up on AZ mentioned that that Josh normally, you know, is his bread and butter is to put down hard shots. He said he kind of missed a couple of shots that were very, very difficult to try to get a run started, and after missing one or two of them, it kind of, he said he struggled a little bit with confidence and ended up missing a couple more. So to your point, he never really was given, you know, so what I've learned, man, about playing some of these guys, there's a lot of guys, when you play at the amateur level, you can wait for an opportunity and you'd be like, sooner or later, they're just going to hang a ball or give me ball in hand or something. Yeah. But when you play at the high levels, there are times when nobody gives you an opportunity. And so for Filler, he didn't have, you know, he just wasn't right ready to take on those tough shots, and he just was, just for once in his life, he was just a hair short. And meanwhile, all it would have taken would be for Lee Van to corner a ball, and Josh could have just ran through a rack or two and gotten to turn things around. But so to Lee Van's credit, like, man, talk about just, you know, if any part of Josh was like, well, sooner or later, the guy's got to give me something, it sounds like Lee Van was just like, nope, not going to happen. You're going to have to earn it, you know, and he just didn't really get much of a chance, it sounds like.
Yeah, I think that's essentially what happened. And good for Levan. I mean, it's, there's, I mean, well, I guess I'll take this from the other side first. I mean, there's nothing that Filler can do. I mean, he played the match that he was able to play, and there's nothing that you can do about somebody who never misses a ball. There's a lot of, I guess, analysis that we have where if a player wins a match, it's like, oh, yeah, well, that player just, you know, they didn't give their opponent an opportunity. And most of the time, that's a little tongue-in-cheek. I mean, obviously, they had opportunities, right? But they didn't take advantage of the ones that they did. This is a situation where Filler just didn't get an opportunity at all. Levan was beaten God. For anybody who plays like the Ghost, the God is a variation of the Ghost, where the Ghost is you break the balls, you take ball in hand, and you try to run out. God is where you just break the balls and run out, or you lose. You don't take ball in hand, and if you scratch on the break, you automatically lose the game. I mean, Levan would have beat God in that game.
Well, I'll tell you what, I didn't tell you guys this, but in 2019, I played Derby last year as well, and I think I made it to round 7 in the 9-ball, and Levan was the one that beat me out. And I've played a number of top players, and I've gotten run over a few different times in my life, for sure. But I'll tell you this, Levan, when he was playing, I actually felt like there was a weird gear that he hit where I didn't even feel like he was playing 9-ball. It felt like he was playing straight pool. And I don't know what I mean by that, except for the fact that, like, sometimes when I'm in my chair, you know, I'm like, when a guy's breaking the balls, I feel like, well, maybe I'll get hooked, or maybe I'll get kissed, or maybe I'll lose the cue ball, or maybe I'll have a hard opening shot. Levan had that break dialed in when I played him to where it didn't even feel like the break was a spot where something could really go wrong and maybe it's wrong. It just felt like, and I remember it was like 1-1, 2-2, and somehow maybe it was 3-3. And then something happened where I was just sat in my chair for 5 or 6 racks and watched him run out the set. And it was like, it really didn't feel like, it felt like straight pool in the sense that it didn't really feel like there was anything up the luck. Like he had the break going where he was playing the 1-ball a certain place and the cue ball and cross, you know, crossing the cue ball and crossing the 1-ball and playing it in front of the corner and all this. And it was just like, and it just looked like a continuous run of straight pool.
Funny.
So that's how I got eliminated last year, and that's what I remember about. I've only played Levan once, and that was my experience with the guy. So good for him. I guess I've got good company now.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess we can kind of get to the actual when we were finishing up. I think Billy was playing Justin Hall last week for the first place in the one pocket. Obviously, we already said Billy won, and we kind of talked a little bit about that, so we can move on from there. The 9-ball, we just kind of talked about a little bit, I guess, too. But the official placings for everybody was Levan Corteza wins over Joshua Filler. Third place is a tie. So third, fourth goes to James Aranis and Dennis Arcoyo. Fifth, sixth, and seventh, so fifth through seventh, is Justin Bergman, Shane Van Boning, and John Salim. And a lot of people, so his first name is actually pronounced C-A-N. And that is a German thing. So Jean is actually German, and that is pronounced, C-A-N is pronounced Jean. So if you see his name around, don't call him Can. He's used to responding to it, but the pronunciations of his name is actually Jean Salim. So 8th, 9th, 10th goes to Conrad Zunchenzem.
Forget it.
Yep, exactly. J-U-S.
Conrad J.
J-U-S-Z-C-Z-Y-S-Z-Y-N.
A lot of Z's and C's and Y's and S's.
Demetrius, do you know how to pronounce that name?
Why would you do that to me?
No, don't do it to him.
Okay, well, yeah. So Conrad, and he actually is a monster player. He's one of Europeans kind of, and this is kind of weird to say, right? Because the Europeans seems like they have a billion players who can play just so strong, but Conrad is one of the European players, I think, that kind of goes under the radar, but is really actually in that top tier of players that you just don't hear necessarily a ton about. So we'll just go with Conrad. And so Conrad, Jonathan Pinegar, and John Gabriel. And we will go back to the 11th spot, too, because probably my favorite goofy player of all time is in this. So I gotta say this one. So 11th place through 19th place, I guess, is Francisco Bustamante, Josh Roberts, Jason Shaw, Chris Melling, Tyler Steyer, Omar Al-Shaheen, Mizesco Forchunsky, Stefan Holm, and Nayuki Oi, which is how he likes to pronounce his name when he plays in the Whirlpool Masters, and it makes me happy.
So you don't want to read any of the names that finished 20th, huh? No, I'm just kidding.
Oh, yeah. I read some of those already.
Actually, I don't. We're going to go through the 20th, too. We're going to go with Demetrius Gelatis and Warren Kiamko, Evan Lunde, Marco Tauscher, Chuck Sampson, Michael Yednek, and Nicholas Hickerson. So, of course, we got to give a shout-out to the great Demetrius Gelatis for joining our podcast.
Did you
get to watch close up a fella named Jesus Atencio?
Well, I got to play him on the AccuStat stream table.
Yeah, Rob, okay. we were talking on the phone when he was playing.
Oh, so that's who you were playing, that Atencio. Now, he kind of impressed me, too, along with that Omar.
Yeah, so
his fluidness, you know, and his stroke pocket.
Omar's definitely levels above him. Omar's one of the best in the world right now, in my opinion.
Okay.
He's under the radar good.
But Jesus is he's on his way. So I had not seen him play before. He took, I think, fifth through eighth in the banks. The one pocket rather. I think he tied for like top eight in the one pocket.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you what, he does everything right. I was impressed by every part of his game. His pattern play was good. His pace of play was good. His break, he really, really had that breakdown.
He did break nice, yeah.
And if we want to talk about like what were some of the differentiating factors between the winners and the losers, there's still a lot of players that haven't figured out how to break with the nine ball on the spot, which that seems like, hey, listen, I practiced my 10 ball break for years, and all of a sudden I looked up and I realized that everything was nine ball again, and I must have been asleep at the wheel, because I'm like, why am I not practicing my cut break instead? But I'll tell you, he really, and so the people that did well in the nine ball, I can tell you that the people that have that cut break down have a major advantage over people that are still trying to figure it out. And so anyway, he had it figured out, and his safety game was really, really good. So his speed, his pace, his decision making, his cue ball, and his striking. He had a couple of shots where he had to like shoot elevated shots down rails, and he really strikes. I was really impressed. I know that right now, in terms of like for Fargo rate and whatnot, his rating is still on the climb. But I look for him to be one of the top players in the U.S. here over the next 3-4 years. I really expect him.
From what I saw.
When I look at some of the. I really think he's got a bright future.
Kind of a bad break there. I remember when the balls were just messed up. The six was on one rail, the seven was on another, across the table by the side pocket. And you ended up playing, a 3-4 cushion safety shot on the six, is what it looked like to me.
Yeah.
Rather than trying to pocket it and get shape on the seven, just went down the rail and scratched, which is kind of.
That was a standard. I remember that shot. It's a standard four rail safety when the object ball's past the side pocket and the cue ball, you're straight on almost like a cross corner bank.
Right. But there was no bank there for you.
Yeah. But you bank into the end rail. So it goes side rail, end rail, side rail.
Right.
Side rail back to the end rail. But the problem is the cue ball. I know the cue ball is going to hook with high ball and run down that rail. So what I tried to do is I was trying to cut the six just a little so the cue ball wouldn't hook and force follow along that end as a side rail. But the problem was, and the one thing that got me was that they put me on that AccuStats table and the balls were really hyper polished and extra clean. And it almost hooked like it was like, I've been playing on these gritty tables all over where they don't polish the balls and the ball just would not arc like that. And so, I ended up scratching on that shot.
But, yeah. It looked like a weird way to scratch because it was side spinning down the rail. Yeah. Well, it was the opposite way. I mean, it's spinning right to left as it's going down the right rail.
I knew when I hit it. I knew when I hit it. I meant to cut the ball just a little bit, and I didn't cut the ball.
Okay. Right. Yeah, then you would have hit the rail right away with the cue
ball.
Bottom
line is that Jesus Atencio, for those of you guys who are wondering who the next top U.S. player is going to be, I'm calling it here. I expect that over the next 5 years that he is going to be a top, top five, top 10, but probably top five. Like I look for him to be a Moscone Cup candidate here in 2 years.
For sure. Yeah. I totally agree with that from what I saw. I was impressed. And his demeanor too. He looked pretty young.
Yeah.
And that's what I see too. You know, a lot of the European players, they're all young, but they really have a presence, at the table. And it's not cocky, really. It's just powerful and strong presence. It's kind of cool to see a player's at that young age. Well, Tyler's a little bit same way.
Yeah.
Okay, Nate, want to say something?
Okay, off I go. I was just letting you guys have your discussion. You guys always have good stuff, so I just get out of your way. I'm good at that. So I guess we can wrap up our discussion at that point. I think we've covered all things Derby City, and unless there's anything else that you two would want to like discuss, I think
well,
that's...
bank ring game.
Oh,
Billy Thorpe,
that's a really good idea.
Guy yeah. Second.
Yeah, and that's yeah. So I guess that's a great idea. Billy Thorpe wins it. Sky Woodward gets second place. And they flip-flop from last year. So Sky Woodward actually won it last year, and Billy took second. So they flip-flop places this year. And the bank ring game is always so much fun to watch. It's they always take eight, and everybody gets some poker chips. And every bank is worth so many poker chips. And usually it goes up after a certain amount of time. So each made bank gets you more poker chips the longer it goes on. And it's just a super fun thing to watch. It's super entertaining, and I've actually played in a, one tournament like this, and it was a blast. They're fun switch of events, and yeah, I mean,
see a couple of three cushion players names here for the nine ball mini. Dan Louie came in second in the nine ball mini, and David Grossman won the one pocket mini, and he plays three cushion.
Well, I think of, when I hear those names, when I hear Grossman and Dan Louie, I think of pool. But I'm sure they play three cushion as well. But
they play pretty good too.
Yeah, I'm sure.
They're not over. I don't think they're over a one average, but they're good.
Yeah. So I guess we threw out that as well, so we can now move on to the very very few upcoming events that we have. So actually going on right now, and we will start our discussion out with this. John Mora and Justin Bergman are actually playing in a race to 100 where John Mora gets 15 games on the wire. Like I said, this is going on right now. It starts on Wednesday the 5th. There is almost a 0% chance I'm getting this episode out tonight because I'm going to have about 3 more hours of work to do to get these podcasts ready to be released, so I'll probably have to do them tomorrow. But I'm actually watching it as we speak, and John Mora at one point in time was up 18-11 with his games on the wire, which means he was down 11-3 on the day, and it is now 25-17 John Mora. So if you take away the 15 game spot, Justin is up 17-10 on the day. We can talk a little bit with you, Demetrius, on this, and we can kind of ask you what you're looking for in this match and who you expect to win, what the score might be, basically your thoughts on the match as a whole.
Yeah, I find it to be a very interesting one. And, you know, I had an opinion coming into this, but I'll be the first to admit, I thought that it was, you know, there's times when matches, I think, are pretty one-sided, where it's like anybody that would get their money in on a certain side, I kind of wonder if they've taken temporary leave of their senses. With this matchup, I mean, I can understand why people would want to bet John. You know, I mean, he's a top player. He's, you know, I mean, he's a consummate professional. He shoots extremely well. And since he's rededicated himself to switching hands, you know, I mean, Mike Page, the guy that runs the Fargo rate, he did some analysis, and, you know, John's been performing at a 791 Fargo playing left-handed for the last, you know, 6-8 months or whatever. So clearly from that stance, it's like, you know, he's getting 15 games on the wire, which is in a race to 100. That's a pretty big spot. So it's like, you know, what are we expecting? I mean, like, in some ways, you almost have to figure, like, that's pretty good to get your money on John. But here's the thing. Justin Bergman, he's something else, man. He people underrate him because he's not a tour. You know, he's not out touring in all the events and winning world championships. But this guy, you know, he just stays in his hometown, practices on his own, and then somehow has the heart and the confidence and the talent to get in the ring with guys like Shaw and guys like, you know, he'll just get in the ring with, you know, last year at the Derby, he played that Kevin Cheng, who I think that guy beat me out of the one pocket. Anyway, so it's like he gets in these matches with, and he just plays top players, and he's just got a ton of confidence. So I think it's easy to look at John Mora and think that, well, I mean, how's Justin going to give him 15 games and win? But number one, Justin plays better than a lot of people think, especially for the cash and playing for the money. It is different. I don't know. You know, I know that John played Alex Olinger a little while ago, but I know that Justin has a lot of gambling experience. There's a couple other factors I think are important. One, I was told that the pockets are 4.25. You guys confirm that? Were they playing on tight pockets?
So I'm looking at this. I'm actually watching the stream as we do this. Not loosely watching the stream as this podcast is going on. And the pockets do look pretty tight. They don't. Yeah, I can't verify that because I'm not listening to the audio. But they do look tight from what I'm looking at on the stream.
So I think that's a big difference. Like, I think that if they're playing with a magic rack and freshly polished balls and they're playing on tournament conditions, like a new diamond table with new cloth and a magic rack and 4.5-inch holes that play like 5-inch holes because of the slidey rails, then I think what happens is that 15 games becomes a lot bigger, even though they can both run a lot of racks and everything. But I think that what happens is there's less pool to be played. Whereas when the balls are really, really gritty and the pockets are tight and the cloth might be worn, I don't really know. But in any case, I think that the tighter pockets make that race to 100 longer and they make each rack more difficult. And I think it favors the better player, each rack. And that, you know, if John is getting outplayed by Justin and being outmoved and being outkicked and being outshot, then I think the tight pockets are going to take a bigger toll on John. And so I think that the fact is that I think the tight pockets really favor Mora. I mean, I'm sorry, they favor Bergman over Mora because Bergman is just a little bit more street fighter, and he's just, I don't know, he's a real gritty guy and he shoots real straight. And I think he can, you know, I think it's going to cause more moving games. And I think that I think that Justin's a better mover. And so the last thing he wants it to do is be a run out show. He just wants it to come down to where every rack there's multiple moving battles and he can just let his small edges dominate over the course of the night. And then the final thing I'd say is that I've seen these guys play for money before and Bergman hasn't booked many losers. And so the only time I can remember him losing, I think he lost playing one pocket to Justin Hall or something, but like for the most part, like when he, and I'm sure he's booked losers, guys. I'm sorry if I don't know which ones they are, but the point is he did
lose a big match to Corey Duell playing Barbox eight ball about a year ago where, he was giving Corey Duell, 3 games to 30.
Yeah, I think I remember that. I didn't watch that one, but I think I heard about that. My point is this, though, is that sometimes when two players match up, you got to look at who's the one that hates losing more. And some people like to match up and get action just to get action, and other people like to match up and win. And, like, there's certain players that really don't like to lose. Like, Shane does not like to book a lot of losers.
Shane does not. Yeah, I agree with that.
I just don't see the guy booking a lot of losers. And I'm not saying John does. But I'm just saying, I feel like John's on the streak where I think John's trying to get to the highest level he can get. You know, he's been a top player for 13, 14 years. You know, I think he took second in Turning Stone when he was 17 back, like, you know, 12, 13 years ago. I think he's 30 now. I think he's switched hands. And I think he's kind of like, you know what? I've always been pretty good. What do I got to do to get to the top? And I think that he's willing to get in the ring and play tough players and mix it up with guys. Like, I feel like John is in a spot where he's trying to develop his game, whereas I feel like Justin's trying to book a winner. And so my three factors, again, are, number one, the pockets are tight. I think that favors Bergman. Number two, I think Bergman just doesn't like to book losers. I think he wants the win a little bit deeper than John does. I think John's looking to build experience and just – you know, it's just another match to him on his journey, whereas I think Bergman's here to win it. And then I think finally, I think that Bergman is just a little bit better player than people give him credit for the cash. And so you mix those things together. And when I saw it, I'm like, on paper, if they were playing on newly recovered diamonds with fast cloth and, you know, whatever, then maybe I think it would be a real tough match. But I think on tight pockets, I just think that Bergman's the grinder. I think he gets there.
So let me play devil's advocate. I almost completely agree with you. I think Bergman is the favorite here, even though I'm watching him hit a shot that actually was a very, very poor safety. The joys of being able to watch and record at the same time. But I agree with you that I think Justin is the favorite here. And if I was to bet, I would have put my money down on Bergman. with those table conditions being how they are. But if they were playing on 4 3/4 and they were playing with a magic rack, I think that this if there's one thing about Justin Bergman's game that isn't as strong as his peers, meaning like really the top players in the world, is he does not have a break that competes with Shane Van Boning or even Tyler Steyer or even Sky Woodward, players like that. His break is not quite on par with theirs. There's obviously the bigger the pockets, the more the break comes into play. If this was on a 4 3/4 pocket, or just even standard pockets, would that influence your thinking of this match?
Yeah, I agree exactly with what you just said. I do think that John's break is, he probably has an edge in the breaking department, and that Justin was wise. I mean, to select these conditions because, to your point, it reduces the importance of the role of the break and makes it more about shot making, moving, and striking, which is really where Bergman has a little edge. And so, yeah, if they're playing to where, it's bigger pockets, slidey cloth, and balls tracking under the break, and they're playing 7-ball, 8-ball after the break, then I think that race to 100 is a lot shorter. I think that it neutralizes the, John's a great player. Let's not cut him short. I mean, he's one of the best players in the world. And so if he's playing on conditions where he's not struggling to run out and he can just break and run out just like Justin can or as often, then I think you're going to find that set goes a lot quicker. It plays a lot shorter. And I don't really know what that, maybe Bergman still has some edges, but not enough to make up for a 15-game lead. And so I think that if they were playing on soft equipment, especially with a magic rack and big pockets and new cloth, like I think that under those conditions, I don't know that I'd want to give him 15 games if I were Bergman, but Bergman didn't. That's why he put him on the gaff table, and he's like, well, I'm not going to let you run out after the break, so you're going to have to beat me. Like, you're going to have to beat me 85 games where we both get to shoot twice because you're not going to run out on this crap. That's what I think his move was. So good for him. It worked, it seems like.
No, I think that's exactly right. I agree completely with your analysis. And you do like to do a little bit of gambling on these matches. You like to put a little bit of money down. And so not only do I want to hear your analysis on how you kind of break down gambling matches, but I want to give mine as well. And I'll give mine first because mine's uneducated and stupid. But when I look at these matches, I kind of like to put players in tiers. And what I mean by tiers is the top players in the world is my tier one. And that is players like Shane Van Boning. That is players like Sky Woodward, Joshua Filler, Jason Shaw, Dennis Arcoyo, Wu Cha-ching, players like that who, they can get on the table and they can beat anybody in the world at any given time. And they're not necessarily a huge dog to any of the other players at the same time. I have the second tier, which is like the touring pros, but you're not going to see them really in the top eight regularly. Maybe they'll put a good tournament together and they'll get, a fourth place finish in some event. And then there's a third tier of players, which are like maybe they're touring pros, maybe they're just top amateurs, kind of like where you're at, Demetrius. I'm not trying to offend you or anything, but, players like yourself, Alex Olinger, Shane McMinn, players like that who, could really put together a big tournament. They're going to be the favorite of they're probably going to win any local tournament that they go to. But, if you put them in the U.S. Open, they're probably not going to place top 20. Maybe they could finish 13th through 17th if they have the tournament of their life, something like that. And that's kind of how I like to look at these gambling matches. And I'm looking at this match as John Moore isn't quite in that top tier, but Justin Bergman absolutely is. And when I look at this match, I think, what does Justin Bergman need to give up to make this a competitive match? And on these table conditions, I'm thinking probably 20 to 23, 24, something like that. So I actually like Justin Bergman in this match by a little bit, probably about 8 to 10 games is where I put this. So I think Justin Bergman will still, with the 15 on the wire, I still think he'll win this 100-90-ish. And that's kind of how I look at my gambling matches. With whatever conditions are in place when they're matches like this. So with that being said, I like Justin Bergman. How do you break down actually when you look at events like this and how you handicap them?
Yeah, I think that, I agree with the tiers. I actually probably have more, I might use like semi tiers in between because I look at it like you've got, like you said, Alex, I'm sorry, Shane and Filler and Wu and, you know, Dennis and, like, the absolute Jason Shaw, the absolute elite that are, like, the pre-tournament favorites. And then I consider it, like, a tier down. Like, I consider Justin Bergman, Alex Pagulayan these days. He's not a favorite in these big shootout events, but he could still get there. So guys like Mike DeShane, Bergman, Kevin Cheng, Clint Dikachi, you know, all these guys that are kind of, like, around that 795 to 805, you know, even Lee Van Corteza, you know, guys like that, they're all kind of like a tier. They're a tier below. Like, there's no way that you can say that Justin Bergman, Clint Dikachi, and Lee Van Corteza are going to be pre-tournament equals to, or even Alex are going to be pre-tournament equals to, like, Jason and Filler and those guys. So I consider those guys, like, in a, it almost like a sub, like a tier down, just a hair of a tier down from the elite top champion favorite players.
I would give a tiny pushback on Eklanti. I do think Eklanti is in that top tier now, but that is just a preference for me. I think Kachi is, I think he's there, but that's neither here nor there. Continue on.
Yep. And so, and I, by the way, I played Kachi in the 2017 US Open, lost to him in my first round. And then felt kind of bad until I saw what he did to everybody else. And then I, after he beat his second opponent, I bet on him every match the rest of the tournament, all the way through the finals. And he won. He got all the way to the finals and lost to Shaw. And even though I paid off one bet in the finals against Shaw, why did I bet I'm going to get Shaw? Because he won the previous eight matches. Why would I stop? You know what I mean? It was superstition at that point. But anyway, so you don't have to convince me the guy's a great player. However, in practice, he also hasn't been in the finals of, or even the final four of a major tournament that I've seen in the last year and a half. So you just can't put him, you can't say that Clenty is there with Filler and Shaw and Shane when he just doesn't have the results that they do. I think he will be. I think he has the game to do it. But anyway, so the bottom line is, so I got my top tier, I got my sub tier, which is like Alex and, you know, Bergman. And then you go down a tier, and then you got the guys like the Chris Mellings, the John Moras, the Corey Duels. Like you say, they can win at any, you know, they can still get there, but there's a skill gap. And then yeah, you've got the tier below that with Josh Roberts and Shane McMahon, and, you know, maybe I'm in that or whatever, depending on how wide that tier is. But so yeah, it's a great way to look at it. And I do think Bergman is a tier above Mora. But the other thing is that then you got to look at it and say, oh, and one of the reasons I like to look at it that way, too, is because I've learned I'm a nervous sweater. When I bet on other people, it's hard for me to watch. And so it's hard for me to bet on people that can really go into dog mode. And so I like betting on the top tier guys, because it's like when you bet money on Shane, when you bet money on Filler, it's like, it's just, it's fun, man, because you don't have to sweat it. You just know that they're going to run through those racks, and they're gonna, very, very seldom are they going to, like, you know, we're going to be like counting your money, like, oh, this guy can win from here. Oh no, I can't believe he missed. It's so painful for me to bet on people. Dog it.
The only time that they really lose is when a Lee Van Corteza comes out and runs seven straight racks. Like, that's the only time that you're going to lose on a Joshua Filler type of bet. Yeah,
that's right. When you pay it off, you usually won so many bets by that point that when you pay it off. So my gambling strategy is pretty simple. It's bet on the elite players because they usually get the job done. But then where it gets weird is when it comes to weird games. Like, one pocket is a weird game to bet on. And another one is that these tables with the 4.25 pockets, that people have to understand, it's no longer 10 ball the way they know 10 ball. I mean, those 4.25-inch pockets changed the game. They might as well be playing snooker. They might as well be playing three cushion billiard. I mean, it's a different game. And the reason why, here it is. Every game, I mean, you already talked about how the break goes down in importance. Well, what happens is every game has a pie chart of skills that are rewarded. And so I think about it almost like, you know, like in those old, you know, video games where you get to, like, pick your race car, and some race cars have very good acceleration but low top speed, or some burn up a lot of gas but they have good cornering or something, and you get to pick whatever race car is good for that turf. Well, with pool, you know, I talked about, you know, what skills it takes to be successful: generating opportunities, converting on opportunities, cue ball speed, you know, safeties, kicks, whatever it is. What happens is, as you change games and as you change equipment, changes which skills will be pivotal and which skills will determine the outcome. And in fact, one of the things I think is funny, a lot of times what happens is when a player says, well, I don't like a certain game, what they're actually saying is, I haven't developed the skills necessary to be successful in that game. So players that don't like bar table pool, because they're like, well, maybe they're very good at, you know, maybe they're very good at running out tables on tough 9-foot tables, and then they go to bar pool. They're like, well, everybody can run out. It takes away my edge, and what a stupid game. But what they don't realize is that when you play bar pool, it's still pool. It's just pool where the break and kicking and safeties and moving and shot making are actually rewarded at a high level because it's all about generating opportunities and getting control of the table because everybody can run out. And so if you're used to playing on tougher equipment where people give you opportunities and you've built your game on just running out balls better than other people run out balls, well, then, yeah, you're going to be scratching your head on a bar table wondering why nobody ever hangs up a ball for you. And you don't realize it's still pool. It's just rewarding a different skill set, which emphasizes the break and moving and kicking and coming with hard shots and jump shots. And so to me, like when you go to 4 1/4-inch tables, it changes the game. And it's no longer rewards. So John Mora has a skill set built for tournament pool. And you take him off of tournament and you take him off tournament tables and tournament pool, and you put him in a gambling match on 4 1/4-inch pockets. The skills that John develops don't translate 100%, and people just don't realize how different of a game that is. You know, the importance of the break goes down, but then it's a game of striking and moving. It's a game of moving and it's a game of striking. And John's game is a game of tournament 10 balls. It's designed a little bit more towards, you know, what John does well is he runs out routine runouts very, very, very consistently on normal equipment, you know. And I don't know, man. It's hard to put it in words, but I just think that – so, yeah, I agree with what you're saying about the tiers. I think Bergman's a tier above him. But beyond that, I just think that you've got a guy who's honed his skill set for a certain game and conditions that's being taken out of his element, put in a trap. And that's gonna impact his confidence. It's gonna impact all kinds of and his shot selection, his judgment. He might make some weird decisions because he doesn't even know what the percentages are because he's not really comfortable or used to it. It's gonna manifest in all kinds of different ways, such as, you know, game management, shot making, you know, confidence, decision making, all kinds of things. And it's too bad, man. I think it would almost be more interesting for Bergman to give him the same spot on a normal 9-foot table afterwards to see how that match would work out. But anyway, I mean, it's good. Whatever, as long as they both agree to it, whatever they want to do, they're the players.
Yeah, for sure. Rob, did you want to chime in on that?
Oh, no, I'm listening. I'm sucking all this in, baby. I'm not too old to learn, you know. You may think I am, but I'm not.
You were like me an hour ago. No, this is good stuff. And I hope this is good content for the listeners on how to actually look at these events. And, you know, with Demetrius being on the podcast going forward, I think it's a good idea for us to start doing a type of gambling actual implementation to the podcast and start talking a little bit more about how we handicap these events. And, you know, for an event like this, we could have talked about. So I'll ask you this, Demetrius. I actually kind of gave what I think the handicap should be. And I think the handicap should be probably closer to 23 games on the wire to 100. What do you think that the line should have actually been to make it 50-50?
So this gets into a weird spot because it's, when it comes to handicapping, there's a funny thing that happens, which is, I'll tell you what I deal with sometimes. Cause I have to give up when I play locally in Minnesota, I usually have to give up handicaps. And one of the challenges of handicapping pool is that let's suppose I'm playing a guy that plays way under me. Okay. And we're playing straight pool and we're going to go to 100 points. And let's suppose that the actual skill level, I should be able to give the guy 70 points to 100. Okay. Because on average, for every 100 points I score, he'll score 30. Okay. So let's just suppose that in the beginning, though, the handicap isn't enough. And so in the beginning, I only have to give him 50 points to 100. Well, I beat him. And then I give him 60 points to 100. I beat him again. Well, now I end up having a spot of 70 points to 100. You think, well, now it's fair. But now what's happened is I've just beat the guy twice, and he's lost me every time. And so I'm going to play well, but he might struggle, and he might play bad, and he might not be able to visualize winning, and he might still get nervous, and he might just dog it off to me to where even though he has a chance, he just doesn't even really show up, and I end up winning again. So now I give him 75 points to 100. And now he's the favorite, but he doesn't know he's the favorite because all I've ever done is beat him. So he dogs it off to me again. So now I give him 80 points to 100. And you know what? The guy can still find a way to lose because I beat him so many times and he just can't believe it. And he just misses everything and I still beat him. Now, guess what? Now I give him 85 points to 100. And all of a sudden, something clicks in his head. And he's like, this guy can't give me 85 points to 100. All I got to do is make 15 balls. And all of a sudden, instead of being nervous and struggling with belief and being tight and dogging it and all that, all of a sudden he gets comfortable. He's like, well, I'll just shoot 15 balls in the hole. Hell with this guy. And all of a sudden, that handicap will go from being where I'm winning to where I'm not. I don't even have a chance. Because now once this guy's comfortable, you know, he's getting way too much weight. And so my point is that it puts handicapping as a really challenging thing because – if you'd say, well, you beat up with 85s or, you know, you beat up with 80, so then 85 was fair. It's like, well, maybe I shouldn't have been beating him with 80. And so now that that spell's broken, I could go back and give him only 80 now, or I could go back and give him 75 now, and maybe I'm still losing. So now I got to lose and lose and lose and lose and lose until he comes down to the point where things balance out again. So my point is that handicapping is really difficult because it's not just what's going to physically play out, but it's what the players believe they can do. So to put it another way, if John Mora was getting 23 games to 100, that might be so many games that if he knew he was getting 23 games to 100, he might just make up his mind that there's no way I'm letting anyone beat me like this. And I refuse to believe that's possible. I'm not going to allow that. And something might click to where he just says, there's no way I'm not getting to 77. I absolutely will win this.
Yeah. And but I can actually jump. If you don't mind me jumping in there too, you're kind of talking from the lesser player. And while I'm not a 730 Fargo like you, I am a I'm a 660. And I know giving up, I've played in a lot of tournaments where I've actually given up seven. I have to win a match 7-2, meaning I have to give four games in a race to seven. And just knowing that I have to give four games in a race to seven, so 7-3 for a match, that makes me play extremely tight, knowing that I can't make a single mistake, seemingly, because if I do, I'll lose. Taking the opposite side of that, the lesser player could get comfortable, but the better player could get really tight too, knowing that they can't make a mistake.
Yeah, and so I think I think the conclusion and where I was going with this, what I think is interesting, if John Mora was actually getting 23 games on the wire from Justin, then I think maybe he would just be able to say, his desire to win might go up, his confidence might go up, and he'd say, I don't care what size the pockets are, I don't care who this guy is, I'm not allowing this guy to win. And something deep inside of him may just say, you ain't letting this guy beat you 100-76. That ain't happening. You're going to win this one, Johnny boy. And so I think if he was getting 23 games, he'd probably be the favorite to win. But here's the funny part. But if he's getting 15 games and he doesn't know that you and I are side betting on him not getting to 77 or whatever, then, you know, then maybe Bergman is the favorite to hold him, to beat him by 23, as long as he doesn't know that that's the line. Like, if he thinks the line's 23, I think he's going to get there. But if he thinks the line's 15, then he might end up losing by 23.
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting thought experiment on
funny,
the human psyche.
Funny way to look at it. That's probably fairly true.
It reminds me, you know, it kind of reminds me of something. I had a friend that was playing in an exhibition match, and, you know, he's a really good guy, and he was playing a match where, you know, there's a lot of people watching, and they were playing on tight diamond tables, and it was, you know, one of his kind of premier, like, you know, first time playing as an exhibition in front of a bunch of people, and he was probably a little nervous. He's playing a better player. And so I think they were racing at 9. And I want to say this, he was down like, I don't know, 4-3 or something. And they were on break and he ran to the bathroom. And so he was coming back from the bathroom and I walked up to him and I said, hey, I got a question for you. I said, if somebody bet like $2,000 that you'd get to 7 games, would you want to know about it? Or would that make you nervous? Would that throw you off? And then he just looked at me blankly and said, never mind. Forget it. Forget I said anything. So anyway.
Oh, my God. If somebody did that to me, I think I'd die.
I told him I was just joking around. I was just having fun with him because we're friends and stuff. And I understand how funny it is to be, you know, I mean, he's breathing, you know. I love the game. The game is fun, and pressure is a lot of what makes the game fun. So I had to have a little fun with the guy.
Yeah, Rob, I got to ask you this question too, because I think with you being around the game for the 97 years you've been on Earth, I think this is a really interesting thought for you. But like, I care so much more about other people's money than I care about my own money. So if somebody tells me that they came up and they bet on my match for me to win, oh my God, I'm terrible. I'm terrible at playing on other people's money.
I dig in.
Oh man, I mean, I
play better.
I'm not saying that I don't play better.
If it's your money I'm playing with, I play way better.
Well, I'm not saying that I don't play better. If somebody came up to me and said that they have a $2,000 side bet on me, that might be too much to where that's too much pressure on me, because I do care. If somebody came up to me and said they have $50 on me,
their last $2,000 and they had five kids to feed, maybe I
well, first
feel
off,
that
I might
way.
Tell them they're
otherwise,
an idiot.
No.
I'll tell you what, guys. You know, funny what when I was 17, I had a guy I used to play pretty close with that lived in a different town. We got together a few times and played like, you know, 100 or 200 a set, and we'd always been pretty close. We both broke even, so we broke even two or three sessions like that. And I think one day we just decided, you know what, we want to just get it over with. So somehow we were going to play a 8 ahead for 500, and I had somebody else, this guy backed me. He's like, I was kind of hesitant. He's like, I'll back you. I like your end of it. So he backs me 8 ahead for 500. And I get in the ring with this guy. And it was just one of those nightmarish, humiliating sessions where the guy started off by winning like four games in a row. And then I couldn't get going. And kind of like a filler against Levan, I guess. It seemed like the last three balls were always laying funny. And he's making billiards on the nine. And I ended up losing 8 in a row, and I lost 8 ahead in 8 games. And nice. I was the drive back to Rochester was a long one, and I felt so bad, and I felt so guilty that I ended up paying my backer $500. I gave him his money back. I said, you know, I couldn't even live with myself. And so I just paid him back the $500, said, I can't even have you lose any money for that. And then I thought about it afterwards. I'm like, well, if I'm going to pay my backer back when I lose, why even have a backer? And so then after that, I didn't ever have a backer for a lot of years. And now, you know, of course, I usually just bet my own, but not to say I never do anything. But like, anyway, I thought that was pretty funny. That's why I rarely get backers involved, because I can't handle it either. I don't want to lose anybody's money.
Yeah.
That's funny. Yeah. Yeah, you have a heart and a soul.
Well, now, if I lost 8 ahead 8 games now and had a backer, I wouldn't even bat an eye. I'd look at my backer and be like, man, I'm glad that wasn't my money. You hungry? You want to grab something to eat?
I'm totally now.
Is this a bad time to ask if either of you want to back me in a couple big games coming up? I guess I'll cut us off there, and I think we've had a pretty good discussion about what to look for in gambling matches, and this one specifically, and I'll give one more update, because I'm actually watching the match as we speak. John Mora is up 26-18 with his 15 games on the wire. I was going to say Justin Bergman is running out to get to 26-19, but he almost hooked himself and actually got a pretty fortunate roll. So I think he's still on his way to 26-19. So
everything else I said, I got to tell you, I really like both players. I like Justin Bergman. I think I always root for Justin, but I'm also in not just in this match, but in his career, I'm also rooting for John Mora. I like he's kind of a lone ranger. He travels to tournaments. You know, sometimes he has his girlfriend there at Derby, but a lot of tournaments he goes to on his own. He just listens to his music and goes to his matches, and he plays his heart out, and he tries to do everything he can to be the best pool player he can be. And I think that, you know, from a purist perspective, I'm a big fan of both guys, and I'm kind of pulling for John Mora to make this a match. And I would love to be eating my words in a week. I'd love for John Mora to come back and take this back and play some great pool. And I hope they both play good. And whoever ends up winning, I hope it's a well fought battle. And I think they're both going to have a lot of good days in pool ahead of them. So.
Well, I hope that Justin Bergman does win by exactly 193, because my ego cannot take being wrong on Billy Thorpe after kind of proclaiming myself so smart last week to having Dennis Arcoyo come and just rip my heart out. So I can't handle 2 weeks in a row of sadness. So Justin Bergman has to win.
Fair enough.
No, I agree with you on everything you said on John Mora, though. I agree. John Moore is a good dude, and so is Justin Bergman from the time I've been around him.
Right on, guys.
Yeah. So we will move on to the end of the podcast. So we have gone super long at this point. Actually, I mean, as far as actual phone time, we've been on the phone for 2 hours and 30 minutes between the three of us. So, but that is insider information that doesn't need to get to talk about. We are at 2 hours for the podcast thus far.
It's going to be two podcasts.
I know, but that is a lot of work for me. But basically what I'm saying is there's going to be no discussion this week. We are going to move on to the end of the podcast, which is basically our two tips, which is now going to be three tips. Demetrius, again, this is going to be
a quick tip.
Yep. This is where we kind of give the listeners something that they can take away from the podcast to work on with their own game, as far as incorporating different things that have helped us get to where we are with our games. Rob, do you want to go first with this one?
Yep. I'll throw this up, and I've talked about it before, but I am a firm believer in this system for every pool player out there for every level. And that is, if you're playing a rotation game, you look at two balls ahead of the ball you're shooting. And that's how you decide how you're going to play your position on the next ball. So if you're on the one, you look at the three, where it is on the table, where it's laying. And then in order to do that, you have to look at the two. So you have to look at the one ball and where you're going to play the two to get on the three. And then same way in eight ball, I'll take three balls at a time, and I'll go. And in eight ball, of course, you have nice options that if you don't get to exactly where you got to be, you can always change the next two balls if you want. But I always take that third ball and look where you need to be for shape on that ball, because it also not only gets you to where you need to be, it focuses your mind on pocketing the first ball and getting shape on the second one. So it does more than just get you to the third ball. So there it is. I preach it all the time, and I just think it's true.
Yeah. I will go next, and my advice is going to be, and this is going to be kind of spawned from this weekend at the last event that I was at in Danbury, Wisconsin this past weekend. And ironically enough, my friend Mark Eifler and I actually played in a two-man there 2 years in a row now. We drew the same exact team first round both years. And one of the players on that team is actually a listener to the podcast, so shout out to John. And I wanna give my advice kind of based off of the reaction that he had when he found out that he had to play us first round. You can reach out to me and tell me if I'm wrong on this, John. But I kind of think that John kind of counted themselves out in the match before it even started. So my advice this week is going to be, especially for some of the lesser players who are coming up through the ranks and kind of taking their beatings, learning the game from, you know, better players, is do not be intimidated by whoever you're playing against. I know it's very, very hard to do, and I know it's super cliche, play the table, not your opponent. But there is something to just trusting in the practice that you have in the game. You've been preparing your entire life to basically play this game. So I always go back to this analogy. If you are going to walk a mile, you do not take your first 2 to 3 steps thinking, oh my God, how do I walk? How do I put one foot in front of the other? Your body just knows what it's doing, and it just does it, right? So you're not constantly worrying about not tripping over your feet. In fact, the only time that you really get in trouble with that is when you think about it. It's the same way with breathing. You know, everybody breathes just fine until you focus on your breathing, and then it seems like you can never get a deep enough breath to catch up. So if you just let your body do what it's trained to do, if you just let your pool game do what you've trained it to do, you're going to have a lot better results, I think, than if you're constantly worrying about who you're playing against or how well you're going to play. Just trust in the training and the practice that you've put in up until this point in your pool career to be able to put the best game that you have available out there on the table. And that'll be my advice this week, is trust in the process that you've had up to date to put yourself in the best position possible to play your best game. So that will be my advice. Demetrius, you want to take it away?
Yeah, those are both really good, and I've got a lot of different ideas that I'd love to share in the weeks ahead. So for something quick and easy, I'll just think of something that, speaking of three cushion, something I kind of learned playing three cushion, which is I usually, you know, kind of like as part of a shot checklist, I'll sometimes find myself asking myself, okay, how thick am I hitting this ball or how thin am I catching this ball? How much spin am I using? How hard am I shooting at this shot? What speed do I need? What spin do I need? What thickness do I need? And if those things ever line up to where I hear myself thinking, well, I need to hit this about as thin as I can possibly hit it, with as much draw as I can possibly get, and as much spin as I can possibly get, as hard as I can possibly get it. If all three of those things are as much as possible, as hard as possible, as thin as possible, then I stop and I get up. I'm like, this can't be the right shot. And so it's amazing that when you're playing position, you know, you can find yourself kind of like, you got one shot that's almost possible, and then you're like, how do I make that shot possible? Well, if I catch it really thin and really hard.
That's a huge difference between pocket pool. I know I've not played pocket pool now for 4 years, basically, except once a week. But I have played three cushion almost every day. One thing I did learn that I didn't know for the first 3 years, and I'm still not sure about it, but now I'm getting more sure, is in pocket pool, generally speaking, the last thing you look at is the object ball. And I was told by a fellow named Loopy Cruz out of Chicago, a very, very good player. He averages over one. And that is not so in billiards. He says the last thing you want to look at is billiards is the cue ball. He says it's more important to know where the tip of that stick is hitting that cue ball than it is where the cue ball is going.
Yeah, and I know that, you know, that's another conversation with pool. There's different people on the break or shooting off rails or over balls or jump shots that same advice applies. But I guess my point, you know, it reminds me is like when I first started playing one pocket, one of my goals was to make it through an entire session without anybody ever telling me good shot. I had in my head that if anybody ever told me good shot, then I feel like I must have done something wrong, because I really just want to keep the game simple. So if anybody's going through their pre-shot kind of shot selection checklist, if you find yourself like winding up, like you're swinging for the edge of what's possible, look to see, maybe there's something that's not quite as extreme.
That's really sound philosophy. Yeah.
If there's any pushback I can have on that, there is a time in a rotation game, like let's say big table 10 ball, where that shot is the only shot available. But if you're thinking that for 8 ball, especially bar box 8 ball, then for sure you're looking at the wrong shot. Every now and then, that extreme, there's no other shot. This is, although there are safeties available, right? So even then, a safety is probably usually a better option.
And I guess that's the same thing as I'd say. I'll give you the tip sub A then as well, which is the other thing I was going to say is if you're in a really tough spot, don't take the first option you see. If you feel bad about it, try to find a second or third choice, because then even if you like your first choice the best, If it's a tough, tough, tough spot and you give yourself two or three choices, then even if you pick the first choice, you get to feel like I am selecting this. I am choosing this. This is the path I believe in, as opposed to feeling like you're backed into a corner and this is your only option. And so for me, I just think that in terms of like perspective and approach and mindset on the shot, if you give yourself two or three choices and then pick your favorite one, it makes you feel like you're in control and that you're picking your road forward, as opposed to feeling like you're just kind of backed at a corner and you're a trapped animal, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. We don't like that feeling. The trapped animal. I don't like that on the pool table.
That's how John Moore is feeling right now.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. I just look at my opponent and say, what'd you do that to me for? I'm a decent guy. I'm a trapped animal now, buddy.
Yeah.
I like that analogy.
Yeah. So I guess at this point we can wrap it up. I will thank a sponsor to the podcast. And this week, for my sponsor, I'm going to thank the Wisconsin State Pool Players Association. And that is because they have the state tournament coming up soon. And if you have not gotten signed up, you're not going to get signed up. So bummer. But they have given me a free booth for this coming year for a we're going to switch away from being actually a sponsor to the podcast, and we are going to be more of a partnership. But I am still going to consider them a partner, if not a sponsorship, to the podcast, because, you know, that's kind of what I want to do, is I want to help the people that I believe in and help promote the stuff that I believe in, and the people that I don't, I'm just going to not have associations with as much. So the Wisconsin State Pool Players Association, I thank you generously for the partnership that you have done with the podcast. And that is Greg Andler and Bonnie Hunkins and Jeff Martin and all of the people on the board that I'm not naming, but all of those players, thank you so much for your partnership. And with that, Demetrius, this has gone super long, but this is your first introduction to the podcast. And I would like to think that a lot of the content that we had has been super good, and a lot of players are going to get something out of this. So thank you for joining us, not only for this podcast, but going forward.
My pleasure. Thank you, guys.
Yep. Thanks, Demi. See ya. And Nate, see you.
Yeah,
you too, Rob. Till we meet again. Yeah. And all you pool players out there, hang around. We're coming back for more.
Oh, yeah. Hey everyone, thanks again for listening. If you like what you've heard and you listen through iTunes, please subscribe and leave a rating. It helps others find the podcast. As always, thank you to our sponsors, Jacoby Custom Cues, Cody's Cue Therapy, Jeff Glaz's CBD for Life Global, the Wisconsin Billiards Hall of Fame, The Rocks Sports Bar and Grill, the IQ Practice Cue Ball, and the Wisconsin Pool Player Society. If you like what you hear, consider supporting the people who support the podcast. I would also like to take this time to thank Matt Kitzman, Robert Miller, Natasha, Kurt Elliott, Scott Doolian, Corey Smith, William Sutherland, and Mike Teasy for their help to market the podcast to a larger audience. Lastly, I would like to thank my cousin Andrew Mindham for his band Hey Captain Knight's music as segment and filler music to the podcast. If you like what you hear, you can find all of his music at heycaptainknight.bandcamp.com. And Knight is K-N-I-G-H-T.